Thank you. Good afternoon. I am pleased to court Anthony DeMary here on behalf of State Center Community College District. I appreciate you taking this appeal for discussion today. The position I'm presenting here, that there were errors made in granting the initial order, which was an injunction on a co-equal government body. And the failure to determine the forum status, the order clearly made a decision they did not need at the trial court to determine the forum status, and the failure to apply the school speech doctrine, which would be under the Planned Parenthood Hazelwood decision, which I'm quite aware that has come before this court before. I've reviewed Judge Warlaw's opinion in Oyama. I'm ready to discuss that, why it should apply in this, and why I would agree with you that Oyama was not the best vehicle for application, but that if we follow the four other circuits, 6, 7, 10, and 11, that have applied the Hazelwood school sponsorship doctrine to secondary education of junior colleges and colleges, this is the case and this is the opportunity.
Let me ask you this. Putting aside for a moment the Hazelwood issue, Board of Airport Commissioners versus City of Los Angeles versus Jews for Jesus, which is a Supreme Court case, says we don't need to consider the nature of the forum in an overbreadth and vagueness case. What's your response to that?
It's an interesting question. Is when you look at the cases, when you go to the school sponsored doctrine cases in Hazelwood and in Hazelwood and Planned Parenthood, for two current examples, both of those cases, the forum was discussed. So in you look at what happens in a school speech-sponsored case. In those cases, the law is clear. It starts in Hazelwood and goes through on our own Ninth Circuit Planned Parenthood that such great deference is given to the school itself because of the imperpeture issue, that the forum does become important.
Because, well, as you know, part of the issue of Hazelwood is you're dealing with either K through 12 or you're dealing with college. In this case, we're dealing with college. But even before we get that, your previous regulation, if you want to call it that, indicates that inappropriate or offensive language or themes would not be permitted. Can you give me some examples on what inappropriate or offensive language or themes might be?
Certainly. Okay. Let's talk about some examples, and then if I could, in that answer, discuss why it's important following Hazelwood and Planned Parenthood that it's not so specific as to start delineating who can get around it. But examples might be, when you look at the cases, some of the important factors are the school district's own interest in its education and those things it promotes and those things it doesn't. Slightly outside of the school speech doctrine, you have the Bong Hits for Jesus case, which was not a school speech case, but nonetheless, the important topic right there was, okay, the school has an interest in not promoting drugs and stopping drugs. So there's one.
But with respect, you're going afield from the question I'm asking. You have this regulation about inappropriate or offensive language or themes. Very vague, very indefinite. I'm asking you, you're one of the administrators now.
Okay.
The ones in this case happened to be confused. They didn't quite know what it meant. So I'm asking you, what does it mean? Give me some examples of what that means. You're the administrator now, and you're going to say, okay, A, B, C, and D meet this criterion. That are inappropriate or offensive.
That would have been my first one there, would have been promotion of illegal drug use.
Okay, would everyone have agreed to that?
Would everyone in the – certainly the people who put it up would not have agreed to it. No, of course not. Okay. No.
And how are people who are supposed to abide by this to know what is and is not covered?
That's a great question. It goes to this core issue of the deference given to the school district, because certainly I would concede your point. Judge, I would concede your point that when you look at the school sponsor doctrine, none of the cases from Hazelwood on through Planned Parenthood, I'm sorry, even on to our fellow districts, have given a specific statement, and they're very very open description. Hazelwood, I believe the statement was immoral. Anything that is immoral or illegal or in bad, a similar language I have written down. And Planned Parenthood, I think it was very similar. Hazelwood was, the principal has a discretion to say if it's legal, moral, or ethical. Planned Parenthood, the rule was, does not serve the best interest of the school. And the reason I bring that up is you're not going to have a situation when you look at school-sponsored doctrine where the people that want to post will always know what violates those rules. They didn't know it in Hazelwood, and they didn't know it in Planned Parenthood.
So basically you're saying that a regulation cannot be drafted that would not run afoul potentially of overbreadth and vagueness just because nobody can possibly define all of the things out there that might come in. Is that what you're saying?
I'm not. But to explain the point, when I've reviewed the cases, it does start with a forum analysis, and the forum analysis is non-public forum.
Yeah, but why? I mean, I get your point, but I read you earlier on, Supreme Court case says that we don't have to consider that in terms of overbreadth and vagueness cases. So just arguendo for a minute. Let's assume that the forum to this degree is irrelevant.
Okay.
Let's talk about vagueness and overbreadth. I'm struggling with how people are supposed to interpret the language there. It seems like your administrators did have trouble doing that. And that's one of the things the Supreme Court's been pretty clear about. You know, you got to be real careful. You're going to restrict people's speech and their communication. They've got to know exactly what it is that they're doing wrong. And I'm asking you, what are some examples? You said you gave us one, and that's probably a good one, but what are some others?
Gun violence certainly is one that we'd be very interested in if I was the administrator, because it would also be pertinent to the issues in this case. If a student body member wanted to post with our school and perpetrator and our stamp on it, picture of one person holding a gun to the head of another one.
But they don't do that. In this case, they were signed by the people who put them up. The school had nothing per se to do with it, unless you get to your forum analysis, right?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand that.
I understood that what was being placed was these were signed by the people putting them up, and the school had nothing to do with it. There was no sign saying the school sponsored it. Is that correct?
Only partially, Your Honor. If you look at the record in this case, they were called back in to make an insignia to give a description of their group. But I believe the evidence, I know there are some things that are on motion to dismiss and some on appeal. I believe the evidence here is that there was a social media handle to a national group. But no, I don't believe it clearly designated that these groups were not under the approval of the school, because you had to be approved and stamped to be on the board. And the board, recall, is not a random board. It's our wall. It would be akin to stapling on this wall.
Right.
So with your example, to take that, it's certainly a point that we looked at coming into today on the overbreadth and vagueness. And what you find in this is the reason I believe it's so important to get to school-sponsored speech, because what you find in the school-sponsored speech is that from the Supreme Court's approval in Hazelwood all the way through our fellow Sixth District case in the Sixth Circuit, there are less descript rules that go to the discretion of the school, because the imperpeture is going to be attributed back to them, to their own imperpeture. So the reason I word it that way is you had worded your question as, does that mean it's always going to be overbroad and vague? No, Your Honor, what I would say is if the school-sponsored speech case, then the opportunity to be constitutionally compliant allows more freedom and more of a less certain description, as we saw in the Hazelwood case.
With young people, the K through 12.
Well, thus far in the Ninth Circuit, depending upon how you look at the Brown versus Lee case, mm-hmm. thus far, it has not been applied, but has not been rejected. Four circuits have applied it to the colleges with very similar language to what we have here. And if can I address that for a moment? Why we should extend it? If I could address for a moment why to extend it. And if you look at the Sixth Circuit case, which I believe is the Hostry case, they do a good job of describing that in the Sixth Circuit. And it actually, it was one of the citations from the Oyama case from Judge Wardlaw. What they describe in that case is that there's very little distinction between high school juniors and seniors and college freshmen. They show that the ages actually can be similar, and sometimes high school students can be older. In our junior colleges today, of course, by statute and constitution, there's an obligation to provide the education to members of the public here in those junior colleges. And in State Center, as the junior colleges around this state, there are joint programs with the high school. So high school students actually come into the campus during their high school years to take classes so they graduate with their AAs. In addition, these are buildings that are used for other purposes, not just for school purposes, especially the hallways, where we have family members, members of the community, and certainly children that come through constantly, whether it be for athletics or other purposes, that are exposed to these walls. The thing I look at now, when you talk about the K through 12 originally in Hazelwood, if you look at the reasons given, there are multiple. One is to control the materials that are presented to K through 12 students given their age. There are curriculum issues, but the last is the most important. And the last in the Hazelwood, which was described to an extent in Oyama very well, is that other members of the public might reasonably perceive these items to bear the imprimatur of the school. That is not something that is specific to the age of the student. That is the members of the public. That's straight out of the Hazelwood Supreme Court case. That was what we followed in Planned Parenthood. That regardless of the age, others may find that the posting actually is reasonably perceived to bear the imprimatur of the school. And what that causes for the school, not just for curriculum, because in Planned Parenthood, it applied to giving out athletic materials at a game. So you get ads, you put together a brochure, and you hand it to members of the public. I'm going to reserve the last two, unless you have questions for me on this.
Let me interrupt you. I'm going to change gears just for a second.
Yes.
Are any of the plaintiffs still enrolled in students in the school?
Check their names. My belief is no. I will defer to counsel, but I have been told no.
Okay, so the answer is that none of the plaintiffs are still enrolled as students in the school. Is that true?
I hesitate to say it's true. That is my understanding, but I am not 100% sure.
Okay.
None of them are still in the school, does that moot the case?
Their case?
Mm-hmm.
I would be pleased if it would.
No, I understand, but is that your position?
The only problem I have with that position is the individuals would be gone. Young Americans for Freedom is still a party, and it is a body. Otherwise, certainly.
Well, let me follow up then. I take it from your argument that the school, it will not disclaim its intent to reenact the policy.
Correct.
Okay.
Yes. I do want to reserve my time back.
Your time. It's fine. Two minutes. You've got it.
I'm sorry?
You've got your time.
Okay.
Yes.
Would you like me to continue now, or you'd like me
no,
to?
No, you can rebut.
I will come back and rebut at that time. Thank you, Your Honor.
2 minutes and 39 seconds is when he asked for it.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Daniel Ortner from FIRE on behalf of the Appellees in this case. Clovis Community College officials used an overbroad, vague, and viewpoint discriminatory policy to remove flyers from a student bulletin board merely because of the conservative nature of the speech and that the speech offended some students. The language in the statute that in the flyer policy that it doesn't allow speech that's offensive or inappropriate is as overbroad and vague as imaginable. It could sweep all kinds of First Amendment protected activity in its reach, and it gives Clovis officials unbridled discretion, as the record here clearly shows.
So do you think the replacement policy is any better?
It doesn't have the provision about viewpoint discrimination, which is what's before this court. We may have some disagreements down the line, or down the line we may consider amending a complaint. But before you, the only policy here is this viewpoint discriminatory policy that's now not on the books anymore.
So, do you think on the motion to take judicial notice, you opposed it? But shouldn't we grant it?
This court can take notice of the fact that the new policy doesn't have the provision about offensive and inappropriate speech. I think what we opposed is down the line what we may or may not do with regard to amending a complaint. That's what we oppose. Speculating about what might happen down the line once we consider our options. What's before the court is this provision that the district court correctly found was viewpoint discriminatory, overbroad, and vague at its core. And so, and this provision also it bans offensive speech, which is textbook viewpoint discrimination. It strikes at the core of the First Amendment. And so, any of these grounds can be an independent basis for this court to affirm the district court's decision that the preliminary injunction should have been granted.
Let me follow up on her question. When Clovis enacted a replacement policy, it did not include the challenge provisions.
Correct.
On appeal, the parties argue over whether the replacement policy moots the case. I'd like you to assume that we find the appeal is not moot. I'd also like you to assume that we affirm the district court's preliminary injunction order. With those assumptions in mind, here's my question. Could defendants file a motion with the district court asking it to dissolve its preliminary injunction because the replacement policy makes it unlikely plaintiffs will be irreparably harmed while the case proceeds? And if so, would the district court act within its discretion if it dissolved the preliminary injunction order based on the changed circumstances?
No, Your Honor. They could file that, but it would be improper to grant it under the voluntary cessation doctrine. This court's case, the FCRA v. FBI case from this court, is the one really very much on point. And also the opposing counsel actually cited two cases from other circuits, the two speech first cases, one from the Sixth Circuit and I believe one from the Fourth Circuit, that are very similar fact patterns. University has a policy enjoined. They argue now, they replace it. They argue now the case is moot. In FCRA, this court said when something is done by an administrative body or officials, it can be easily reimplemented. It's not like a legislative enactment. They could easily put it back into place. There's no presumption that they will not do so. And here they've not disclaimed it. They've not said we would not ever reintroduce the policy. They've not admitted it's unlawful. So under the voluntary cessation doctrine, the underlying case would not be moot.
I want to get back for just a second to what my colleague raised a minute ago. That's who's still attending Clovis. I believe the question was who's still there, and the thought was nobody of this original group. Is that accurate?
The plaintiffs, the individual named plaintiffs, have graduated. They were leaders in the student club that is still a chartered, recognized club that's going to continue being active at Clovis Community College.
Okay, and from your perspective, the club itself is the party then? Basically, it's a representative party, or?
Well, the current leadership will be replaced shortly. The semester ended recently. They're going to have a new board, new president, new vice president, and so they would fill into that role as
have anybody
officers.
Like that now, or is it just a titular organization without anybody in it? Right?
There is membership. It's not in the record before this court, but there is membership. There is a new leadership that's going to continue beyond the semester.
They've already been elected?
There is a new president that I believe has been elected. I don't have that in front of me. My understanding is that there is a new leadership.
And does it matter if you have all three plaintiffs, who of course are the first people listed here, and they're all gone? As to them, if they were the only party, the case would be mooted, right, at this point?
With regard to prospective relief, we also are seeking damages for past injury, so that would not be mooted. But for prospective relief, if they were all graduated and had no injury, assuming that capable repetition would not, exception to mootness would not apply, that they
okay,
would.
So your point is, no matter what, there are damages.
Yes.
For past injury. As to the future, you think the organizational standing is sufficient?
Yes, YAF is a recognized student club that's posted flyers. They've been targeted repeatedly for discriminatory treatment based on their conservative views. Here, just before you, there's evidence of the two sets of flyers that were rejected because of the conservative views. There's no reason to think that's going to change now that different leaders are in charge of the club, and so YAF would suffer injury and would be able to continue along with the new leadership that would take over. And really, you know, the record shows, I think, ample evidence of viewpoint discrimination over, and also, as Judge Smith asked the question, what is inappropriate or offensive to opposing counsel? And the answer was, there's a couple things he can point to, but it's such a broad category that it carves out all kinds of protected First Amendment expression. The speech in this case is a good example of that. This is political speech about the evils of communism. It's speech about the Supreme Court's case about abortion that was upcoming at the time. These are matters of political concern, hot topics to be discussed on campus, and yet administrators decided these are inappropriate or offensive. And that really shows the overbreath at work here. That there's no, and the district court said this as well, there's no conceivable pedagogical reason even that a university would enact such a broad ban on any speech that's inappropriate or offensive. And so really that have, regardless of the forum analysis and regardless of whether the student speech doctrine applies, that type of policy is impermissible. That degree of overbreath, the degree of vagueness at heart here, and this, university officials here, their actions exemplify the kind of arbitrary decision making that's offends the First Amendment. And I think the district court said it well, that this, their actions exemplify the kind of arbitrary and discriminatory treatment that the vagueness doctrine is designed to prevent. Deciding to approve the flyers at one point, then someone complains about it, they decide, well, maybe we should take it down, and they use this as a pretext, they use other policies as a pretext to say, oh, it's inappropriate and offensive. That's really exactly the example of what the vagueness doctrine is intended to prevent.
How important is it that there was a substantial amount of discretion on the part of the administrators to decide what and what did and did not violate this stricture?
Under the vagueness doctrine, the Grained case from the Supreme Court kind of sets the standard that there's two ways that a policy could be vague. One is, does it give sufficient guidance to the person who's trying to speak? And two, the second prong is that does it give arbitrary or discretion to government officials? And really, both of those are satisfied here. So each of those would be a reason to declare this flyer policy unlawfully vague. Opposing counsel in the district court and here didn't really dispute any of this. They offered, the district court said they offered little response to the overbreath challenge. They offered similarly little response to the vagueness challenge, why this isn't arbitrary or why this doesn't give arbitrary discretion. They merely say that university officials need that kind of overbroad, vague, kind of standardless discretion to impose the whatever policies they want. And that is just not consistent with any of the cases. Opposing counsel cites no cases where any policy of this nature has been upheld in the college level, a ban on offensive speech or inappropriate material at the university level. We cited a directly on-point case from the Third Circuit, the Macaulay case, where it was a similar ban on offensive signs. And they didn't respond to it in their briefing. They don't cite to any cases that allow this level of discretion. And so on that basis, there's no support for the conclusion that this court could affirm or could allow universities to implement these kinds of policies.
Your opposing counsel suggests that dividing these standards by who the likely readers might be, in other words, K through 12 as opposed to college, doesn't really work because you've got people coming onto the campus that don't fit into neat categories, others that might view this as having the imprimatur of the school. What's your response to his argument in that regard?
On the first point about the people, students, high school students, or families might come, that's true in any public forum or any forum at all. That's true in the local park. That was true in the case the Supreme Court had, the Reynolds case about the drive-in movies were showing content that might have been inappropriate for children. Anytime there's public speech in public, there's a chance that someone young or impressionable might hear it, but that's never been a justification for imposing restrictions. This court and the Supreme Court have repeatedly said that universities are bastions for free speech. They're important places for freedom of expression and debate. This court in the Oyama case.
Does it matter if that's not true anymore?
Well, we'd like to see it be that way, and this court, the courts play an important role in ensuring that freedom of expression, unpopular ideas are not chilled. It's even more important now than ever that this court and courts take a strong stance in defense of free speech in the university setting. In Aoyama, the court said that school speech doctrine failed to account for the vital importance of academic freedom at public colleges and universities. And the Supreme Court has emphasized that that is vital and essential to our democracy in the Kishin case and elsewhere, that having universities be places where students can and faculty and everyone can be exposed to difficult ideas, challenging ideas that they disagree with, is vital to our democracy and to a society that values the First Amendment and protects the First Amendment. And the Supreme Court has allowed even highly offensive speech in the university setting. The Papish case is the best example of this, where it involved a flyer that had an image of a policeman raping the Statue of Liberty, raping Lady Justice, kind of symbolic of criticisms of the government's policies. And so the flyers in this case are well in line and far less graphic and obviously on their face offensive than the speech there, and yet that was upheld in the Papish case. And so universities are bastions for free speech. And that's really one of the reasons that the Hazelwood precedent should not apply, is that unique environment, coupled with the maturity of the students, the lack of the in loco parentis relationship that there's in the K-12 setting. Going to your question again, Judge Smith, about imprimatur and the appearance of the university's kind of endorsement, this is a student bulletin board. AR-5550 designates it for student speech. The record shows that flyers from student groups would routinely get approved in seconds or minutes. They would go to the office and get a stamp. These groups are independent from the university. They're run by students. They're expressing themselves. And so there's no basis for an imprimatur of student expression. And that's very different from the Planned Parenthood and Hazelwood cases, where the record showed that the principal of the school and the teachers leading the journalism class or the newspaper class were very involved in micromanaging what kind of speech would be allowed to be there. And that's not the case here. There's no evidence of that in the record here. And so there's no basis for the idea of an imprimatur concept in this case. So even if Planned Parenthood could apply, and Hazelwood could apply to the university setting, which this court has repeatedly refused to do in Aoyama, in Downs, numerous times has had the opportunity and has chosen not to for the reasons I've already discussed, even if they could do it, there's no basis in the record to say that there's pedagogical reasons here or that this is a curricular speech from the university. And then finally, mentioning in this context, mentioning Planned Parenthood and Hazelwood, also Planned Parenthood emphasized, and this court did so in Downs as well, that even in school speech settings, viewpoint discrimination is not permissible. That's the clear ruling of the Downs case. The court there distinguished between school-sponsored speech, where it said that they would apply the viewpoint discrimination microscope to the policy in question, and the kind of pure government speech scenario where that's a different category. They said that would not apply, but in the school speech context, it does still apply with full force. The same is true for viewpoint for vagueness and overbreath as well. Those doctrines apply with full force regardless of the forum. And so the district court correctly said it did not need to decide what the forum was, because in any forum, a policy that is viewpoint based on its face, banning offensive speech and inappropriate material, which the Supreme Court in Mittal v. Tam and just recently in the 303 Creative case said is viewpoint discrimination. That's impermissible. This kind of broad policy is impermissible, really, in any forum. It cannot be defended. And so the district court correctly granted a preliminary injunction. It correctly ruled that plaintiffs were likely to succeed on the merits. And on any of these grounds, on viewpoint discrimination, overbreath, or vagueness, this court can affirm the district court's grant of a preliminary injunction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
I'll just touch on a few of these issues briefly and then any questions you have. I was surprised to hear a suggestion that there had been no cases or nothing cited to say that similar, less specific instructions had been cited as evidence in other cases that similar terminology for school-sponsored speech had been approved. Of course we did. It's the two most important cases before us. In Hazelwood, our U.S. Supreme Court set this rule, and they said the only thing that the school needed to state was legal, moral, or ethical, completely up to the discretion of the principal. That's the instruction that is allowed when you get to the point where it is school-sponsored speech, see, in perpetuity of the school, and there are questions about whether the school has a discretion, which they're giving great deference to actually adjudicate down through their student body. The other one is Planned Parenthood. And the instruction of Planned Parenthood, when you talk about there could be nothing so vague or overbroad, except that the Ninth Circuit has said it's approved for a school to have a rule that says we're not going to let you post anything that does not serve the best interests of the school at the discretion of the principal. And it's because of the possibility that the actual use of that language would actually give the public to believe the imperpeture of the school is dedicated to that topic. The courts have been clear that schools are not required to take one position or the other or be seen as taking one position or the other on issues that are in dispute, that are of controversy. And the language in Hazelwood, which gets approved again in Planned Parenthood, is very clear that we don't want to make our schools the battleground. So we don't want to say we're going to put this up there and you have to let the first flyer go up, and then we're going to let you force the second one, and that whole wall is going to be a battleground of students with things that you don't approve of. Either one, either that you have an imperpeture problem or that you've created a battleground, and the discretion under those cases, the Ninth Circuit and the U.S. Supreme Court, is given to great deference to the school. I'd notice Papich, not a school speech case. Downs, government speech, not a school speech case. McCulley, rape harassment, not a school speech case. None of those cases are applicable. The ones to follow are Hazelwood and Planned Parenthood. Follow our four other circuits. We apply them to this case. And given the language of those particular rules in those schools are just like AR-5550, and it should be applied. By the way, you have no, last thing I'll tell you, you have no determination from the district court that there is viewpoint discrimination or forum. We don't have any of that. None of that was decided upon. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Flores v. Bennett will be submitted, and this session of the court is adjourned for today.
All rise.